Well, the story we're sharing today is an old story, a very old, old story. 2,000 years ago, in an obscure corner of the Roman Empire, from a small, unimportant village, a strange teacher had emerged. A man called Jesus. At the time, it was a common enough name, still is in some parts of the world. And over a three-year period, this man, Jesus, had gone about preaching and teaching. And along the way, he had collected about him a group of followers, both men and women. And as his reputation had grown, he'd attracted large crowds of people around him. But he'd also attracted enemies. For he criticized the religious authorities for their hypocrisy, for their lack of genuine love and compassion, for misunderstanding the Hebrew scriptures, and in an occupied country, for his country was occupied by the Romans, he no doubt made the political and military authorities very wary as well. Those paying attention also found that he quite regularly said the most outrageous things about himself. He told people that he forgave their sins. We read that in Mark's Gospel and also Luke's Gospel. And though most people of the time believed that only God could forgive sins, Jesus claimed that he could forgive sins. And in the best known of his sermons that's come down to us, the one we call the Sermon on the Mount, he put his own words on the same level as God's words. He claimed to have sent the Old Testament prophets, when everyone else believed that God had sent them. And he claimed that he had been the Lord of Israel's greatest king, David, who had lived 1,000 years before and who had known only one superior, God himself. And yet, in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus claims to be the Messiah, and in Mark's Gospel, he observes that the Messiah is David's Lord. So he claims to have been the Lord of Israel's greatest king, David, when David only had God as his superior. On one occasion, when Jesus was back home in his hometown, the people in his hometown got so annoyed with him that they tried to drag him up to the top of a cliff and throw him over. And on another occasion, when a group caught the implication of what he'd said to them, claiming to be God, they almost stoned him. Over and over and over, Jesus told people that they should follow him, obey him, prefer him over everything else in life, even friends and family. And they were to be prepared, if need be, to give it all up in order to follow him. Well, as we read through the Gospels, we discover that eventually Jesus ticked off enough people, people with power, people with lots to lose, that he was arrested, beaten up, flogged, executed by crucifixion in the capital city of Jerusalem. And that should have been the end of him. He should have ended up as barely a footnote in history, perhaps known only to a few scholars who study short-lived popular movements in the ancient Middle East. Except, of course, that within days of his very public execution, his followers started going about saying that Jesus wasn't dead. He'd come back to life. And now the strange thing is that the authorities had been afraid that something like that would happen. And so they'd arranged to have his grave guarded. They'd rolled a stone in front of it. They'd sealed the stone. They'd placed a guard. But still they couldn't scorch the story by just producing the corpse. They couldn't do that. Because a corpse was no longer a corpse. Just as his pesky followers said. His followers, who had run for their lives when Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane on the Thursday night, his followers who had hidden behind locked doors, were suddenly changed men and women. They were bold, they were courageous, they were standing up to the authorities. It was almost as if they were standing on the rooftops shouting out their message. They were willing to risk trouble. Now, what could possibly have caused that unless they had really seen him and been with him? And even though they lived in a society that devalued and oppressed women, they insisted that it was women and not a man, not even high-ranking women, but ordinary women who had seen the risen Jesus first. At least they should have changed that bit of the story to make it more credible, to make it more likely to be accepted in their culture. Unless, of course, they were somehow committed to telling the truth as they knew it, regardless. And so they told that it was the women who first saw the risen Jesus. And over and beyond the historical account, over and beyond the historical evidence in the centuries since, countless hundreds of millions of women and men have claimed that they are convinced inwardly, in a kind of sixth sense way of knowing, that Jesus really did rise and really is alive today. And even if it's true, as the evidence suggests, well, it's still a very old story. So what difference does it make to us now? Well, to answer that question, I believe we have to go even further back than Jesus' time. We have to go much, much further back, to the dim, misty beginnings of humanity. And in a symbolic way, in allegory, the story is told to us in the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings. And there we are told that God created everything there is, including human beings. He created us to live in intimacy with himself, in harmony with God, ourselves, other people, and the rest of creation. But then came the problem. The disruption of that intended intimacy, that intended harmony, that intended unity. It was disrupted because humanity decided to do things its own way instead of God's way. Humanity, as a people, we decided that we knew better. We decided we would miss out on something good if we did it God's way, that almost as if God was somehow holding out on us. And in the Genesis story, in that allegory, the point is made in terms of disobeying God's instruction not to eat fruit from a particular tree in the garden. But that story, doing it our way and not God's way, has been repeated over and over and over again down through the centuries. And the result? Well, the result is exile. Just like in that Genesis story. We find ourselves apart. We find ourselves in disharmony, in disunity, away from where we should be, no longer in harmony with God, no longer in harmony with ourselves or with others, no longer in harmony with the rest of creation. And most important and most tragic, we are exiled from God. In that Genesis story, Adam and Eve are driven from the garden where they had known God so intimately. And the way back into that garden is barred. They are apart. They are exiled from God. The desire to do it their own way has set the pair apart from God. And in a cascading list, the exile from God means exile from oneself, from each other, from the garden of creation. And we are exiled. We are apart from ourselves. For in the Genesis story, almost as soon as he finds himself discovered, Adam denies responsibility. He can't admit it to himself much less anyone else. And he's uncomfortable now, uncomfortable even in his own skin. And isn't there anyone here who hasn't experienced that? That sense of being somehow distant from ourselves, not understanding who or what we are. We're exiled from ourselves. And then we're also exiled from each other. Think of the next bit of the story. Adam blames Eve. It's her fault, he says. This first small step of apartness, of separation, of exile from one another. And generation upon generation has repeated the story until families divide and whole groups and nations are apart from one another. And at the extreme, just like the Italian knight tried to do, we will kill one another. Just watch the news today from Libya or Syria or Yemen or Cambodia. We see the extreme exile we have from one another. But we're also exiled from the wider creation. Only a few lines earlier in the story was of a wonderful harmony in the garden. Animals, plants, humans living together so peacefully, so in balance. But as the story goes on, the words are different. We hear of toil. We hear of thorns and thistles. Of humanity being driven out of the garden, of having to work hard, laboring with a sweat on our brow, of feeling pain. And just listen later today to the evening news. There'll be things like reports of increasing carbon output, of ocean dumping, of overfishing, of indiscriminate cutting down and burning of rainforests, all sorts of bad news stories. And the results? Well, we've seen it. Rising oceans that drown coastal villages. Droughts that dries up and kills crops. Empty oceans, flash floods. Just listen. And then tell me that this isn't our thorns and thistles for today, our exile from the wider creation. For exile is our condition. That is our experience. It's our human story. And the way back is blocked. And heaven knows we've tried to get back. Across the centuries, how many utopian plans have been made? How many plans have there been to turn the world into a paradise? How many schemes? How many programs? How many self-improvement books have been written? How many have you bought? How many courses? How many gurus? And sometimes we've even been told that we aren't really in exile at all. That everything is or will be fine. Bit like old Mr. Grace in Are You Being Served, coming onto the shop floor and saying, carry on everybody, you're doing wonderfully. When it was really a mess. But we know, we feel instinctively that it's not so, for we are apart, we are in exile, and the way back is blocked. And this is our real problem. And that's precisely why I believe that this old, old story, this story of the resurrection of Jesus, is not just an old story. It's not just something that doesn't have anything to do with me and with you, with us. For I'm convinced this story has a great deal to do with me and you and us now, today. And if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be here in this pulpit, or even in this church, or any church for that matter. For according to the scripture, the resurrection is God's loud, trumpeted announcement that there is a way back. There is a way back. The exiles can come home. For in Jesus Christ, that strange prophet from Nazareth. God chose to come among us in a unique way. Jesus, who was fully human, but at the same time fully God, dying on the cross in his humanity to pay the price for a sinful humanity, rising as a man because of the power he had as God. And imagine that. Imagine God choosing to live as one of the exiles. For that's who Jesus was. And he said so often that that's who he was. And somehow by his death and resurrection, he opened the way back. The way back out of exile. It may be an old story, but somehow Jesus pulled down the barrier. He ended our exile, and that's the good news that we share on this Easter morning. As one of the hymn writers puts, the gates of brass before him burst, the iron fetters yield. And now, yes, right now, Jesus invites the exiles to come home. Just as he invited those long ago, now he invites you and me come home. Acknowledge me, he says, as Lord, as Master, as first concern and priority of your life. Let nothing keep you from this. Not family, not friends, not even the whole world. Follow me. Follow me out of exile into life in all its fullness. And that, my friends, is what we celebrate today on this day of days, on this Easter day, the end of exile. Amen.